Aloha, my name is Mimi Winberg, and I'm a professor at the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. My topic today is how rising socioeconomic inequality in the Asia Pacific region, which include United States, has implication on the security environment in the region. First, I would like to request the audience to put aside any of the political ideologies associated with inequality. Especially in the U.S., this concept of inequality has been highly politicized. We, as the security practitioners and professionals, do not have that luxury. We need to understand our operating environment and area of operations to be effective in our jobs. This socioeconomic trend of rising inequality in our operating environment should be viewed and treated as similar to that of weather, terrain, or time as we formulate our strategies, policies, and plans. This trend is something I have been following since I was the Deputy Economic Advisor at U.S. Pacific Command in 2004. We thought this was a very critical trend for us to track because we believe that it will have a significant impact on the security of the Asia Pacific region based on all the research which I will be presenting to you during this podcast. We, in the Economic Advisor Office, were not the only ones who were concerned about this trend. Admiral Locklear, commander of the U.S. Pacific Command from 2012 to 2015, also believed in the significance of socioeconomic inequality and its effect on long-term strategic environment in the Asia Pacific region. During his testimony before the U.S. House Appropriation Committee in March 2015, he stated that the socioeconomic diversity and population density throughout the PACOM area of responsibility create strategic long-term challenges. These challenges include political instability, social inequality, poverty, increased sensitivity to climate change and natural disaster, risk of pandemic disease, and epidemic drug use and distribution. Admiral Locklear was not the only one who was concerned about the socioeconomic inequality. 34% of the senior leaders and security professionals who came to APCSS Transnational Security Course in 2015 also thought the issue of income inequality, poverty, is their country's top internal security challenge. You can see their responses on this chart. My bottom line up front is like this. Vulnerable societies can be easily exploited, especially so when the inequality aligns with existing ethnic, racial, and religious divisions. Therefore, security practitioners and professionals must understand and recognize the existence of these risks and vulnerabilities within the operation environment because they can pose potential threats to security and stability. To make this point, I would like to show you a selected list of countries which have experienced some level of instability in the Asia Pacific region. Here you can see how Gini coefficients have increased over time and they are correlated with the occurrence of instability in each of these countries. Gini coefficient is a most commonly used index for measuring inequality. It was developed by an Italian statistician, Corrado Gini, in 1912. Gini coefficients was built on the earlier work of American economist Max Lorenz. The coefficient is generally expressed in terms of 0 to 1 or 0% to 100%. 0 being perfectly equal and 100% or 1 being perfectly unequal. Underlying numbers are generally income data. From this table, you can see that India Gini increased from 31% in 1990 to 37% in 2004. What does that increase in Gini coefficient look like? Here is a set of pictures to demonstrate what that rise in Gini coefficient is like in reality. The left top is Gurgaon, and bottom is the Bangalore, and then on the right is a slum in Bangalore, and the bottom right is Kolkata. India is home to half of the world's poor. It has the largest concentration of people living in poverty in the world. People don't know what their society's Gini coefficient is, but they can visually see the gap between the rich and poor all around them. Therefore, it is not a surprise to find the rise of Next Alive movement in India. It is considered the uprising of the have-nots. A former Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, said, "Naxalism was the biggest threat to the internal security of India as Naxalite threats spread along the Red Corridor." Here is a short video explaining the rise of Naxalite movement.
According to a study published in 2010 by researchers at Oxford University, India contains more impoverished people than all of sub-Saharan Africa, with over 421 million living in deep poverty in 8 of India's 28 states, the highest concentration of severe poverty in the world. The Oxford study found that the severity of poverty in some parts of India exceeds that of Africa. India, the world's second most populous country, has seen much economic growth in recent decades due to industrial development projects, although overall poverty has increased. The country has accepted billions of dollars in IMF loans over the past decades and has established policies highly favorable to multinational corporations. Most of the upper and middle class in India support the economic reforms the country has adopted, which have spurred growth. However, this economic growth has been highly uneven, and its benefits have not been shared by India's lower classes, who find themselves marginalized in the face of increasing industrial development and demand for resources. The Naxals take their name from a village in eastern India called Naxalbari, where the movement began as an armed rebellion against India's government in 1967. The movement spread across India's central and eastern regions over the next three decades as it gained support from intellectuals. The areas affected by the Naxalite rebellion include India's poorest and most highly populous states. The ideology has taken hold among various classes of economically and politically dispossessed people in India, aligning them against the middle and upper classes in a bid to take state power. Among the oppressed peoples the Naxals claim to represent are the Dalits, or untouchables, and the Adivasis, or tribal peoples, who often find themselves forced off their lands by the government in the interests of industrial development.
I want to explain that inequality and poverty are not the same. It is true that poverty has fallen by 30 points in Asia from 1990 to 2008. Meanwhile, the income inequality between the rich and the poor has increased by 7 points, meaning the gap between rich and poor has risen. The widening of the inequality gap is demonstrated by this graph. In 1990, more people were living below the poverty line, but overall inequality between the rich and the poor was smaller. By 2008, more people were lifted out of poverty, but the fast economic growth in Asia has benefited the rich far more than the poor. As the result, the gap has widened. The fast economic growth has also created rising level of expectation for those who are at the bottom of the economic pyramid. This phenomenon has set off alarms for many of the policymakers, governments, and academia. The World Economic Forum's Global Risk Surveys, conducted in 2012, 2013, and 2014 consecutively, ranked severe income disparity as the number one risk by likelihood and impact in the next decade. The survey's sample size included over 1,000 experts from industry, government, academia, and civil society. Additionally, some of the prominent Nobel Prize-winning economists like Robert Shiller, Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman have been warning about the problem of rising inequality. Why do economists care about inequality? Well, because economics is a study of resource allocation and distribution. And inequality is disparity of distribution or opportunity. The type of inequality we're talking about here is not inequality based on effort. The problem is the inequality associated with access to opportunity and fairness, especially inequality associated with injustice and fairness, in either perception or real, then we have a problem. Well, a survey conducted by Pew Research Center Global Attitude Project in 2013 showed that overwhelming majority of Americans and Asians believe that the economic system in their country favors the wealthy. So now we have the evidence of people believing that their system is unfair and askew to benefit the rich. Accordingly, the World Bank's lead economist, Branko Milanovic, wrote in his book that severe income inequality is the biggest global risk in the near future, and social stability and the social fabric of a society are torn apart if there are very large income differences. We can see an example of it in Thailand's red shirt, yellow shirts political conflict. Based on these photos, you can see the two extremely different Thailands. The extreme socioeconomic gap creates resentments and breaks down social cohesion. Such condition creates vulnerability for the society and the community, as noted by Branko Milanovic. And then you have someone with charisma and leadership comes along and leverage the situation to meet his or her own personal interest. I have a short video to explain the red shirts, yellow shirts conflict in Thailand.
The 2006 coup that ousted Thaksin Shinawat gave rise to a group of people calling themselves the Red Shirts. In short, they are pro-Thaksin and they're relatively poor from the north of Thailand. They felt their needs were being met under Thaksin's watch. A red government returned to office a year after the military coup, thanks to an alliance of Thaksin-friendly parties. When that ruling coalition was found guilty of voter fraud and removed from office, the Reds returned to the streets and faced a bloody crackdown. The Reds have been largely quiet under the prime ministership of Thaksin's sister Yingluck, but the group re-emerged in recent weeks, fearing a military conspiracy. Now, opponents to the Red Shirts evolved over the years. The original band of Yellow Shirts started under Thaksin's rule. They see him and his allies as corrupt and that they damage the reputation of the Thai monarchy. Their airport protests in 2008 helped see the end of one Red Shirt government, but the movement was crippled when Thaksin's sister Yingluck won a resounding victory in 2011. The People's Democratic Reform Committee have a similar agenda to the Yellow Shirts, but their base is now larger with greater appeal to the middle class and well-off.
As you've heard from the video, this conflict again is between the haves and the have-nots. The head of IMF, Christine Lagarde, insightfully said, "The disparity brings division. History teaches us that democracy begins to fray at the edges once political battles separate the haves against the have-nots." Given all the case studies of inequality across the region, we have to ask, why is this happening? What are the contributing factors for rising inequality across the region? Some economists said that technological advancement and automation are contributing to massive dislocation of many jobs, without aggressive retooling and re-education programs, such massive dislocation stagnates unemployment and contributes to rising income inequality. According to Jerry Mueller, an historian specializing in capitalism and professor at Catholic University in New York, explained that inequality is the natural product of capitalism. The spread and adoption of capitalism with bad governance structures is one of the major contributing factors toward rising inequality in the Asia Pacific. The critical element of capitalism is competition. As such, governments must play their critical role as the referees through good and fair policy, laws, and enforcement mechanisms to ensure the playing fields stay level and fair for all. However, without good governance aggravated by corruption, the markets were skewed to benefit the big businesses and wealthy. Without fair competition, the capitalism became crony capitalism, controlled by oligarchs and monopolies. That's what we are seeing in the region. One of the theoretical underpinning behind capitalism was the Kuznets curve, which theorized that inequality will rise as the developing economies implement capitalistic system, but as the economy matures and transition from developing to developed economy, the inequality will decline. However, based on the work of Thomas Piketty, the French economist known for his book Capital in the 21st Century, published in April 2014, the data is not showing any sign of decline in inequality. Piketty and his colleagues had crunched through 100 years worth of tax and income data for the US and EU economies. What they found was the second part of Kuznets' curve has not been realized in these developed and mature economies. The inequalities continue to rise as they have transitioned from developing economies into developed economies. Here are the graphs showing rising inequality based on the real average after-tax income data in the US. The bright blue on top is income of the top 1%. As you can see, it has risen sharply since 1979. Meanwhile, the rest of the population's income stayed almost flat, thus widening the income inequality in the US. In addition to government policy and technological advancement that has favored few people and the rich, there are also issues of unprecedented levels of CEOs' compensations and moving manufacturing facilities to lower cost areas across the border that are contributing to the widening of this gap. Here is an example of how a CEO's compensation and moving of the manufacturing facilities are linked to rising inequality. In 2016, Nabisco, maker of the Oreo cookies, announced that it will be moving its factories to Mexico from Chicago. This move will save the company about $7.8 million, as you can see from this chart. Meanwhile, in 2014, the CEO, Ms. Mondelez, received an increase in her compensation by $7 million, bringing her total compensation to $21 million, which is 840 times more than an average factory worker's salary. As you can see in this example, how inequality is being created while 600 workers are losing their jobs, the CEO's pay is increased. According to Robert Shiller, amassing wealth in a few people in such fashion also create a drag on the economic growth for the entire economy. Using this example, Ms. Mondelez cannot spend or consume as much as 600 families could. She can only buy so many shoes or clothes or cars, but will never be able to match the level of spending and consumption that would have been generated by 600 families, which in turn drive economic activities and growth. That is why Robert Shiller who was a 2013 Nobel Prize winner, said, "Rising inequality in the U.S. and elsewhere is the most important problem for economic growth and employment. Increasing inequality harms economic growth. High and persistent unemployment, in which inequality increases, has a negative effect on subsequent long-run economic growth. Unemployment can harm growth not only because it is a waste of resources, but also because it generates redistributive pressures and subsequent distortions, drives people to poverty, constrains liquidity, limiting labor mobility, and erodes self-esteem, promoting social dislocation, unrest, and conflict. Therefore, policy aiming at controlling unemployment, and in particular at reducing its inequality-associated effects, support economic growth." Additionally, British researchers and epidemiologists Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett have found higher rates of health and social problems in terms of obesity, mental illness, homicides, teenage birth, incarceration, drug use, among strangers, women's status, drug use, and lower rates of social good like life expectancy, educational performance, trust among strangers, women's status, social mobility, even numbers of patents issued in countries and states with higher inequality. Using statistics from 23 developed countries and the 50 states of the U.S., they found social and health problems are lower in countries like Japan and Finland, and U.S. states like Utah and New Hampshire with high level of equality than in countries U.S. and U.K. and the U.S. state like Mississippi and New York with large differences in household income. Here is a short video of Richard Wilkinson explaining about the result of their study.
Well, what we've done is to look at measures of income differences in the rich developed countries. You can download it from the UN or the World Bank. Simply how big the gap is between the richest and poorest 20% of people in each country. And Scandinavian countries and Japan tend to be the more equal ones. The United States, Britain, Portugal, Singapore, the most unequal ones. And what we then did was to look at a whole series of health and social problems, the rates of those problems in different countries. So how long is life expectancy? What level is infant mortality? What is the homicide rate, teenage birth rate? What scale of drug abuse is there? We went through all those kinds of problems and found that almost all of them are much worse in more unequal equal countries. You find anything from rates twice as high in the more unequal to 10 times as high. And the differences are so large because inequality is not just affecting the poor, it's affecting probably the whole population. We never know about the super rich because they're a tiny fraction of 1% of the population, but we can say 90 or 95% of the population would probably do better if they lived in a more equal society. When I say do better, I mean they'd probably live a little bit longer, they'd be less likely to be victims of violence, their children might do better in terms of the international maths and literacy scores, their children would be less likely to become involved in drugs or to become teenage parents. In that sense, we all do better in a more equal society.
Wilkinson and Pickett's study finding confirm the correlation between higher inequality with higher health and social problems and lower social goods and cohesion. Such conditions create vulnerable population, social and physical environments. Many people see vulnerable environments and population in a country is a domestic internal problem, and they don't have to care about such problems if they live outside of that country. However, forces of globalization, improved connections and linkages, move such domestic problems into transnational domain. When people start to migrate, both legally and illegally, out of their area in search of new opportunities, the problems start to spread beyond the borders. The vulnerable populations are easily exploited by bad actors. As such, they get caught up in trafficking of illicit items and activities, also become easy targets for recruitment by the insurgent extremist groups. Many illegal movement of people have carried undetected diseases and cause outbreaks across the border. The ADB 2013 report warned, inequality can breed social tensions and political instability. This warning has been further supported by Ted Robert Gerd's earlier groundbreaking 1960 study, which was published in his book, Why Men Rebel. Gerd found the relative deprivation, an imbalance between what one get and what one expectation, generates frustration, which eventually turns into anger and then into aggression in the form of political violence. Collective violence can become a normative justification over time under the right combination of geographical factors, demographic factors, and existence of external support to those disenfranchised. As I mentioned earlier, the fast economic growth has lifted many poor out of poverty, but also elevated their expectations. Combine the elevated expectation with their beliefs that the current system favors the rich, which is now confirmed by actual data, it is not surprising to see frustration, anger, and aggression in the form of Naxalite movement, red shirt, yellow shirt conflict, and divided America. To address the rising inequality, the governments must exercise good governance and fulfill their role as the referee to ensure playing field is level and fair. In order to do so, the governments will have to prioritize some of these critical areas. Of course, all of these policy and programs will only be effective when the governments are able to eradicate the endemic corruption that plagues many of the governments in the Asia Pacific. First, it is critical for governments to prioritize adequate investments in quality public health care and public education systems. Equal access to high quality basic, primary, and higher education for all segments of society is essential, since education generally serves as the ladder to move from lower social and economic classes to upper classes. When higher education becomes prohibitively expensive for the average middle-income family to send their children, you're in fact removing the ladder for upward social mobility. In the US, higher education, once seen as the great equalizer and engine for economic mobility, is becoming unaffordable for far too many today. The second important factor is to invest adequately in public infrastructure, such as electricity, roads, ports, transportation, communication, to connect rural and urban areas and to connect producers to markets. Governments must amend policy that favor the rich, such as tax policy that provide tax loopholes and shelters. We know from research that most of the income of the rich comes from investments, while middle, working, and poor generates most of their income through wages. By taxing more of wages and less on investment could be considered a tax system that favors the rich. Use taxes or general excise taxes hurt the poor more than rich, because poor spends all of their earnings, thus paying the higher actual tax rate in such system. A major cause of economic inequality is the determination of wages by the market. Some small part of economic inequality is caused by the differences in the supply and demand for different types of work. there is in fact little presumption that markets are efficient where competition is imperfect. Information is unevenly distributed. Opportunities to acquire education and skills are unequal, and other imperfect conditions are present. This means that there is an enormous potential role for government to correct these market failures. And lastly, enact laws and policies to protect minorities and women to prevent marginalization of these groups. This brings me to one of the key solutions of inclusion, focusing on gender equality. Since women generally are 50% of the societies, if the governments are able to provide equal opportunities for women empowerment, their advancements, and contribution to the societies, we can make significant headways in reducing some of the inequalities in societies. Today, women are the underutilized human resources in most of the societies. If we're able to optimize the utilization of women to their full potential, we can lose these socioeconomic gaps and address some of the societal problems. Today, most of them are excluded from development of the solutions. To quote Amartya Sen, another Nobel Prize-winning economist, women agency and freedom are among the crucial means for enhancing development. Therefore, it is crucial that government's policies, programs, and law ensure and promote equality, empowerment, and fairness for all girls and women. Here is another set of policy recommendations from Asian Development Bank to address the rising inequality. In the area of fiscal policy, ADB recommends increased spending on education and healthcare for the poor, similar to the recommendation I have mentioned earlier. ADB also recommends the broadening of the tax base, meaning to remove tax loopholes and shelter benefiting the rich. Under the category of infrastructure, ADB recommends development of infrastructure in the regions that are lagging behind and remove barriers to migration to broaden access to opportunities elsewhere. Economic growth policy should focus on supporting small and medium enterprises rather than large businesses. Additionally, remove market distortions created by oligopolies and monopolies. That means the government may have to adopt antitrust laws and remove their barriers to entry in some sector to increase competition. Someone working in the traditional security sector, we may not be able to implement many of these recommendations from ADB. However, we as security professionals and practitioners must understand and be aware of the income inequality trends and economic issues in our operating environment. Such knowledge and awareness can provide early warnings for instability and conflict. Additionally, we could consider and integrate these issues into our planning and implementation of humanitarian assistance and disaster relief strategies, civil military operations, and operational contracting activities in our area of operation. To reiterate my original bottom line, it is true that not all society with high level of socioeconomic inequality experience instability. However, all societies experiencing instability do exhibit high level of socioeconomic inequality, because a high level of socioeconomic inequality increases risk and create vulnerable society. If you want to further research into this topic, here are some of the readings I recommend. Thank you and aloha for viewing and listening my presentation today.